The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Barton Simmons. I'm Chip Patterson, and it feels so doggone good to be back on the horn with you, Barton, and starting to look ahead to the college football season. There are real college football lines that are being released right now, Barton, out at the Golden Nugget. The game of the year lines are out. We're going to have win totals coming up here in the next little bit. It's June. July is the beginning of our preseason countdown. I mean, listen, college football is like basically here.
When the preview magazines start coming out, that's a good day. And they're out. I'm still waiting on my coveted Phil Steele. That's going to be really when the green flag goes down. Isn't green flag the one that's the starting flag? What's the starting flag? Checkered flag?
No. Yeah, because green would be out of a car. Checkered flag is to finish the race. The green is to come out of a caution to tell you to go.
So what starts the race? Isn't there a flag that starts the race?
Maybe. It might be green.
Our NASCAR listeners are going to be really disappointed in that exchange. But either way, we're really close, and that's like I'm pretty stoked about getting into the win totals, starting to actually preview stuff, starting to actually make some predictions. Like, I haven't even really dove in yet in terms of, like, you know, when I get asked sort of off the cuff, like, how's this team going to look, or how's this team going to finish, or who's your playoff four or whatever. I don't even really have an answer because I've not done the due diligence yet. So right now it's all gut, and we're getting closer to having some actual information and knowledge behind whatever the predictions are.
Since we've talked last, I backed myself into a little bit of a corner that I'm looking forward to getting out of.
Oh, we're already backing ourselves into corners?
Oh, dude, this was big. So, I might have to stop it because I'm starting to recognize that all the other outlets are doing. I went back for the last 5 or 6 years when we've been 100 days out from the start of college football. I've essentially assembled 100 things that I'm excited about for the upcoming season. It's normally a combination of, you know, the games I'm looking forward to, the players, national title contenders, the stories. It is a great way for me, even for my own brain, to kind of plug into what's going to be going on. And I said in the piece that Auburn was going to win 10 games in 2019. Then Paul Feinbaum had me on his program, and I was like, yeah, Auburn's definitely going to win 10. And he goes, wait, Chip, I really want you to repeat what you just said. And boy, I don't think that, like, Feinbaum's diehard listeners are necessarily, I don't know what the Venn diagram is with, like, my listeners. And so it was a lot of, like, who is Chip Patterson and right, what is right, he thinking? A lot of other, like, and the best thing was I did this right before going to the beach with my family. So it was kind of like a walk off because as soon as I said it on the air, there were like 5 or 6 radio requests that came in, and you're like, sorry, just going to have to let that one marinate. I'm going to the beach.
Oh, that's amazing because that's not like going on, you know, local Raleigh radio and being like, yeah, Auburn's going to win 10 games. That's not even like going on. You could be going on, like, you know, serious national college football radio and saying, Auburn's going to win 10 games, and it's still just going to be kind of a blip on the radar. But if you go down to Feinbaum and say Auburn's going to win 10 games, a rain of hell is going to pour down on you from Tuscaloosa. That's good stuff there.
I'm excited to see how this one goes. It is a big bet. But it's one we've kind of worked ourselves up to over these spring podcasts. Those conversations have gotten me there.
We're in this where we've already begun like convincing each other of things to where, you know, we organically grow together in these ideas and then you can't like fade away from them. And we're already in this, you know, it becomes the season has begun where we have so long to talk about college football season before college football season actually begins that when you start saying something, you have like 4 months to double and triple and quadruple down on it. So now you're out there saying like Auburn wins 10 and it like maybe you, as the summer progresses, you learn more about Auburn's depth chart. You feel, you know, you talk to somebody, you talk to some insiders, you whatever, like you change your mind, but it's out there. So you can't really change your mind now. You just have to like find ways to develop your confidence in it. So, yeah, you're on the record on Feinbaum with that one. So, you know, you better get feeling good about it by August.
Auburn has Florida cycle in on the cross division schedule this year. They go to LSU and to Texas A&M. And I'm out here. Yeah, absolutely. Let's go. I was like, Paul, you know, it's an odd numbered year. You know, Gus is in the corner. He'll figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I respect your I respect that happening, and now that's a good warning for me. Whatever I say, I better be ready to defend it because it's that time of year.
It is absolutely that time of year. Since we last talked to you, one of the biggest stories in college football has been the journey of five-star wide receiver Brew McCoy. And Brew McCoy initially commits. Does he sign with USC also or just commit to USC?
No, he... Yes. Okay.
Here, lay out the facts first.
He was an early enrollee, so he didn't actually sign. So he committed to USC, enrolled at USC, but he committed to USC before Cliff Kingsbury left. He commits. 3 days later, Cliff Kingsbury leaves. So does he stay committed? He goes ahead and enrolls at USC. So he's enrolled at USC in class, like goes to class for like a week, then decides he's going to transfer to Texas, which was his runner-up, which is where he almost committed to anyways, and decides I'm just going to, you know, hope my waiver gets through and I can become immediately eligible. I don't even think the waiver had ever actually gone through. He was still awaiting his appeal. And then he has a change of heart again after going through spring practice at Texas. So he goes to spring practice at Texas, and now he's back at USC and basically is sort of willing to accept that he probably is going to miss the 2019 season due to transfer restrictions. So whatever's going on in that dude's head, whatever's going on in that dude's life, clearly, you know, he's getting tugged in a lot of directions, but that's quite a saga he's taken us through.
So the first thing that comes to my mind when we've got these kind of sagas with highly rated prospects who have not yet played a game, and this is unfair. These are unfair judgments that I have just viewing it, is I say, well, I don't know if he's going to be worth it. Right? Like there is like an unfair, almost antiquated sort of like part of my brain that's like, well, if he can't make up his mind, if he's doing all this flip flopping, like I don't like what that says. And that, again, it is a not fair starting point. And so I'll ask you, from analyzing him, from rating him, from ranking him, do you think that Brew McCoy is the kind of talent at wide receiver that is worth, you know, I mean, Tom Herman got on a plane to go to California to try to get him to change his mind back. It was clearly worth the jet fuel for that. But do you think that his production when he finally does get on the field is going to be representative of all this, is going to be worth all this apparent hassle between these two programs.
So, yeah, Brew McCoy, former five-star, is not your typical flighty, like looking for attention, indecisive guy. Like, this is all a surprise because he actually is a very, like, he doesn't have the kind of personality of a kid that you would expect to do this.
Mm.
He's like a very like business oriented, driven, mature kid from a on the field perspective. And the reviews from him in the spring in Texas were that he is everything they were hoping he would be, like immediately a leader, hard worker, all that. And so I just think that there's some, whether they're family elements, I think there may have been even like a girlfriend involved somewhere in this. And like, there's just, I think there were, and obviously the Cliff Kingsbury stuff and all the, you know, the USC stuff. And he's a Southern California kid, hometown guy. So there's just, I don't know all the elements that have been sort of pulling his strings, but I do think he will be, whether he's like a first round draft pick, I don't know, but I have very little worry that he will be a bust. He will be a good player, in the Juju Smith-Schuster sort of role from a physical competitive receiver, that can, I think, be an impact.
And also on the transfer circuit, for Chris Steele, it was initially Florida, then to Oregon, and right now it's looking like it might be Oregon to USC. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know where USC's coming up with all these scholarships. So Chris Steele, top 100 cornerback from California that committed to Florida, goes to Florida, competes in spring practice, wants to transfer out. We talked about it a couple weeks ago because of his, you know, he couldn't change roommates, who was Jalen Jones, who ended up getting, you know, multiple sexual assaults or some sort of aggravated sexual assault type of allegations. So fair point. You know, wants to leave, whatever. Okay, so he leaves after spring practice, commits to Oregon, like. You know, already Oregon fans are to the point where like they were like, all right, when do we adjust the team rankings because we're getting another, you know, kid that bumps our class up. Well, before he even gets on campus at Oregon, now it's looking like he is actually headed to USC. Not only that, but they had a receiver that was transferring out, Velus Jones, who was in the transfer portal.
He
looks
pulled
like
his name back out.
Too.
Yeah. I saw that.
It's like, I don't know how USC has all these scholarships, but they're making it work. I would love, like, that's the next step. Like, I would love to see, like, public scholarship charts. It's not obviously mandated now, and you just sort of have to guess about, like, what's available for each program or how they're going to make these spots available. But however USC's doing it, you know, that's, hey, they'll take some positive momentum any way they can get it. And for once, USC's got some positive momentum right now.
That's not, you know who the only person that I would count on to actually have that count is probably Ryan Abraham. He probably has it on like a giant board in his office.
Yeah. He can probably, but here's the thing though, is even like often even like the most dialed in media guys or sometimes even like guys in the building are like, well, I don't, you know, there's, like it's so there's back counters and initial counters and blue shirts and gray shirts and, you know, guys that are on, you know, not on scholarship and who are, you know, or guys that are on, you know, medical hardships or what, like there's just all these different sort of loopholes and ways you can sort of spin it that it's hard. Like it's not as simple as just sort of keeping a chart. Like you kind of got to have, you know, be in that room and figure out what they're discussing because it's just so convoluted. So yeah, if anyone has it, it's Ryan Abraham and maybe I'll ask him, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's scratching his head too.
Okay. So if everything is fluid and if trying to figure out, you know, how how your 85 add up for any particular given program. And we've got all this, movement among the players. Like, where do we sit now? I don't want to recycle old transfer portal talking points. I think that on this podcast, the idea that there is freedom of movement among the players, and I'll say this out of my mouth, the idea that players have is about as much, not as much, but about as much, freedom of movement as you could expect in the current climate. I think that that's a good thing. But as with the Chris Steele and the Brew McCoy examples, they have brought out even current college football players, mentioning on Twitter and on social media, like, positives and negatives. The transfer portal itself is becoming a fascinating piece, if for nothing else, but of the scholarship counter.
Yeah. And I think, like, the new talking point is, okay, there's not enough. There's more guys in the transfer portal than there are scholarships available in FBS. And to that I say, okay, there's those guys go FCS, D2, NAIA. I don't know. Go get in where you can fit in. Go play somewhere. Like, that's probably where they should be in anyways. And that's not, to me, is not some, like, death sentence. But it is, it's just creates an environment to where, like, you, like, a director of player personnel is more than just filling out your recruiting board. Like, you are managing an entire roster of available scholarships and outgoing and incoming. And so there's a lot of levers to be pulling. And it takes some nuance and some skill. And I think we'll get to the point where the guys that manage rosters the best, that's sort of an addendum to recruiting the best. And especially at important positions like quarterback, where you only have one and you're going to get transfers out. And so you better make sure you got some incoming depth transfers. You better make sure you're recruiting multiple quarterbacks in one cycle and all those sort of things. So there's just some, I think, new mentalities that you have to take to the roster building process.
Not to go too inside baseball, but does that adjust how the 24/7 sports hive mind sort of changes its approach to trying to cover this all? I mean, other than it makes it 12 months a year, like, there's no off season now. Not that there ever was.
And covering it in terms of
trying to track all the different levers, all the different places where there might be movement, because now we've got the graduate transfers, we've got the transfers, like, because of the transfer portal, you've got more names that are showing up. We've got the on 24/7 sports, the transfer portal tracker. Then in addition to that, the always present, never leaving recruiting of high school prospects. It's like there's three levels to this before we're even sending these guys off to the NFL.
No, but I may need to go, request a meeting with Shannon Terry or something right now and pitch what you just presented have our own scholarship counters.
Yeah.
Have our own, that is borderline impossible to really track. But for a few programs where we're dialed in well enough, we can, we should be able to do that. That's, I think, something that would be really interesting to follow.
I think if we've got fans that are diehard enough to wait for team rankings to update, they would get into scholarship counts.
Say it again.
Like if fans, and I've seen this, especially with Texas, because was it Texas and Texas A&M right now are fighting over who got the highest ranked class?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And McCoy, being a big part of the plus or minus to that. If fans are nitpicking over, like, waiting for transfers to arrive to increase class ranks, they would absolutely be dialed into the idea that my favorite team has three available scholarships and here are those players on the transfer portal that I would like to see. It's like the same speculation that the NBA gets with free agency.
Well, yeah, and the problem with the transfer portal and you know the 25 initial counter limitation with NCAA is like, if you don't manage your roster right, you're gonna have empty scholarships. Like you're gonna have you're gonna have 5 or 6 empty scholarships, and so that's the challenge. And by the way, while we're just thinking about talking about roster management, like in addition to some of these other moves, I mean, Colson Yankoff jumped from Washington to UCLA, the backup quarterback. So Chip Kelly's got a deeper quarterback room now and things like that. But also, we are in the sort of the shadows or the aftermath of the Major League Baseball draft. And one of the, I thought, most important developments there was throughout a lot of the process, Jerrion Ealy, who's a 5-star running back that looked for a while like a potential first round Major League Baseball draft pick, shunned Clemson, went to Ole Miss. He's from the state of Mississippi. Like for a while I thought that the plan was like he's going to play a season of football and it's similar to Kyler Murray, collect a signing bonus and then go play baseball. So like you're getting a 5-star but might only be getting it for a season. Well, he didn't get drafted in the first 5 rounds. He's going to Ole Miss. He's full speed ahead. That means Ole Miss has got at least 2 years of this kid on the football field, and he's a absolute impact freshman. And same thing happened with LSU, is getting a safety named Maurice Hampton out of Memphis, who was a potential first-round pick. He also is going to LSU, didn't get drafted in the first round. So two big sort of additions by just the nature they didn't go Major League Baseball draft in the SEC of guys that will absolutely have a chance to get on the field as freshmen.
Was the anticipation for Hampton that it might be baseball? Because I definitely remember the Ealy conversation. We might have even touched on it here, but I was not plugged into the Maurice Hampton story.
I mean, Hampton had gotten there'd been some first round mocks for him. Mm-hmm. There was always the anticipation he was going to play football and baseball at LSU. And so, you know, unless he had gone like top 15 or something like that, I think that the plan was he was going to go to college, but you never know. And, I mean, Jordan Adams last year for North Carolina was, I don't know that we expected him to go as high as he went, and have sort of no shot at playing college football, which is what he did. He skipped football. So there's always a couple football guys that have a chance, and two big ones are staying in the SEC.
Anything else on your radar before we bring in Dennis Dodd?
You know what? Just one more thing, just because I'm kind of clearing out the notebook, and I don't know when there'll be another chance to talk about this. But CMA Fest is this week in Nashville.
Scooting up. All right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. So this story might not go as may not be as juicy as you're expecting. Anyways, to kick off CMA Fest, there's these like parties that people have here and there. And so I went to one of these things on Monday night, and you know, there was lots of sort of celebrities and music people there or whatever. And there's also some sports people types there. And just because I would have no other reason to talk about this other than right now, and I thought it was interesting, I talked to one guy who was who's a pretty high up personnel guy at an NFL team that you would respect their, you know, their evaluations and how they think of guys. Okay. And
it is not the New York Giants.
It is not the New York Giants. But it's relevant to the New York Giants. So I was sort of talking to him about, all right, well, like, what did your draft board look like at quarterback? And number one was Kyler Murray, and number two was Daniel Jones. And so that's Dave Gettleman sort of talk about like, oh, we knew other people had him number two, and everyone was like, sure, Dave, like, yeah, I bet you did, or whatever. Like, that isn't total BS, because this guy had no reason to lead me astray here. And so he was, and I was like, okay, well, help me out then. Like, why did you have Daniel Jones two? And by the way, they had Locke three and Haskins four.
Ooh.
And so he was like, well, The main reason was, is like when we talked to him, and look, I think the toughness is there, and like all the things people talk about in terms of like he was playing with a bunch of 4-7 wide receivers and was doing, you know, doing well with them. And so, but he also said, like, when we talked to him behind this, you know, when his interview, he was like, he was the most one of the most impressive guys in terms of like his understanding, not just of X's and O's and scheme, but of like the deeper dive of like matchups and why you're going here and what you're seeing and sort of the real granular, deeper, like kind of ingrained instincts of the quarterback position that you need to have. He blew them away in that regard. He said like the only guy that was, and this is the other thing that was interesting. He said the only guy, like the guy, he was almost to Deshaun Watson's level in that regard. And I said, really? Because the whole knock on Deshaun Watson was he came from Clemson and only read half the field and how's he going to develop, pick up an NFL offense and yeah, all that stuff. And he was like, no, well, like that's all true. But when you got him in front of the film room, Deshaun Watson was unbelievable in terms of like, oh, like this, see this cornerback, we're going to attack him because he's yada, yada, yada. And like, oh, do you see this matchup here? And oh, like the things that he's thinking at the line of scrimmage when he's taking them through a game.
Pre-snap. These are all pre-snap decision type
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it's well beyond like, oh, two high, one high safety or whatever. Like it is very, it's just a really ingrained deep knowledge of what you're supposed to be evaluating. And so so I just thought that, again, that's not relevant necessarily this year's college football season, but I just figured I thought that was interesting, and I'm never gonna have a reason to bring that up again unless Daniel Jones starts balling in the NFL this year.
What about the fact that he had Locke above Haskins?
Yeah, and he was talking about how it was really a sort of a mobility thing with Haskins. Like they just are in the NFL right now. Like if you're just a stationary target, which is what Haskins is, that's not really ideal. And so that speaks to Daniel Jones too, who's a guy that, you know, as we're sitting here on Wednesday, like there's like, you know, mini camp video of Daniel Jones pulling it on like a zone read that everyone's all jacked about. That's going to be what to watch with Haskins is if he's sort of pushed off his spot in the NFL, you know, how is he going to do it from a mobility standpoint?
I'm just going to be pulling up those Duke bowl game highlights or that game against North Carolina where he had like, 350 yards passing, 120 yards rushing, something stupid like that.
Right. Yeah.
That gazelle can get downfield. Don't
you
worry.
Yeah.
All right. On the other side, we'll be bringing in Dennis Dodd.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And now it's our pleasure to welcome back to the Cover 3 podcast, Dennis Dodd, senior college football columnist at CBS Sports. Dennis, you had, you know, you drew the short straw to go to Destin, Florida and to go be on the, you know, we've talked often on this podcast about the old hotel lobby beat. You do have a lot of downtime as you're waiting to pick off these coaches and these athletic directors. But in terms of college football, you know, we've got to think that the SEC spring meetings are going to be one of our last opportunities to speak to these athletic directors and to these head football coaches until media days in mid-July. So I guess as a starting point, Dennis, you know, I want to get to alcohol in a little bit, because that seemed to be the thing that reverberated the most with the fans. But even in the downtime among the writers and some of your on-record or off-record conversation with some of the coaches around there, what seems to be the issues that are really resonating on the minds of those power players down there?
Well, all of them were asked about the transfer portal, but it's I've written on it so much, there's really nothing new there. I think one of the things to emerge was, I think a couple of coaches said, you know, is there a way we can get these scholarships back if we lose them? Well, that's opening up a big old can of stuff that hasn't even been discussed. And knowing the way of coaches, they'll use this as a way to run off players to get better players. So I don't think that's coming anytime soon. The portal is what it is. I was kind of fascinated with the fact that LSU got its AD that it wanted, a native son, Scott Woodward, who's supposed to bring in Jimbo Fisher. But boy, Ed Orgeron's sure not cooperating. He's won 10 last year and 19 in 2 years. So I don't know if that's happening anytime soon.
Wait, so you think that that's a long play for Jimbo Fisher? Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is, when Scott Woodward was hired, a lot of people made the connection that because of his enduring friendship with Jimbo Fisher, which was struck up, 2004-03 at LSU when he was there as a director of external relations, that he naturally would someday, you know, entice Jimbo to get to Baton Rouge, which Joe Oliva magnificently screwed up 2 years in a row. I think Ed Orgeron has never been fully accepted there because he was a second or third choice. After all, they went through Tom Herman, Jimbo Fisher, very, very public and running less miles out. I'm not saying it's going to happen anytime soon, but, you know, as I stated in the piece, you know, Ed Orgeron and Jimbo Fisher are each a 7-5 season away from that happening, given the fan bases and the impatience at both schools, if you know what I mean.
Sure. And that piece at CBSSports.com. And if you want to talk about fan impatience at Texas A&M, just look and see Sumlin, Kevin. And if you want to see fan impatience at LSU, see Miles, Les, national championship winning head coach. So for what about Coach O? Like, as you're getting the chance to dig into, you know, dig into what the scene is like at LSU, because you mentioned it right. I think that there is, with Scott Woodward, yes, connections to Jimbo Fisher, but to me, from his history, being a Baton Rouge native, an LSU graduate, it sounds like he's one of these stories in front offices in college athletics where, you know, you basically come up through the ticket office, right? Like, this guy just seems to have had every job in the LSU athletic department. And in that time, as you mentioned, he developed a relationship with then assistant coach Jimbo Fisher. I would think his loyalties first and foremost are to LSU. I wouldn't have any reason to doubt that. But where do you see the current state of Ed Orgeron's program? Because coming off of a 10-win season, there is a lot of enthusiasm. There were massive wins. You go on the road and you beat Auburn. You're really competitive. You take down Georgia at home. I mean, that was probably the game of the year for that team. Yeah. Well, you know, how do you forecast, maybe not even this season or this fall, but just the health of Coach O's program?
I think it's pretty good. I think they're pretty good this year. He's won, as I mentioned, he's won 19 the last couple of years. Since the Troy debacle in September of 17, he's 16-5. In fact, I thought that was one of the better coaching jobs I'd seen in 17, after the Troy loss, because I was there the Monday after the Troy loss, and I've been at more cheery funerals than it was in that football program that day. But he got him, you know, focused and went 9-4. And won 10 last year. So I think the arrows are pointing up. I think he deserves a load of credit, along with his coaches, for developing Joe Burrow, who's now become you know, LSU is so starved for a quarterback that they finally have one. And this transfer from Ohio State, who's become a leader, has embraced everything about LSU, is a better runner, I think, than we thought, and is a big reason that I think LSU could win 10 again this year. You know, Barton, I don't know how you think about it, but I think they're pretty damn good. I think they're in damn good shape right now.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when some of the lines opened up, because everyone's talking about Texas as sort of one of this, all right, yeah, now we've sort of built up our confidence in Texas, and we are, there's no more are they back talk, and okay, Texas is maybe a national title college football playoff contender this year with Sam Ellinger returning. And then when those lines opened up, it was like, I think the opening line was like LSU minus six or something. I think it's down to like LSU minus three against Texas. But that gives you a pretty good idea about kind of how Vegas sees them. You know, they've got so many receivers, and they've recruited so well, and they got a quarterback that I think we're can be more confident in a while. And I think, you know, you probably got to give credit to Ed Orgeron. Like you said, managing the assistants, he's got that guy in Dave Aranda who is sort of the lifer coordinator to me. Like, he's a $2 million coordinator, but he's not the type of guy to me that's going to be at the top of every head coaching list, because he's just got a coordinator personality. And then Orgeron is, he pulled the plug on Matt Canada, and Ensminger seems to have worked. And so, I think at this point, it feels like they know who they are, and that's a pretty good, they're pretty stabilized heading into the season. So, you know, as we all know, it could turn quick in the SEC West, yeah. But it's certainly they seem pretty steady.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. They know who they are. You know, they're settled at AD, they're settled at coach, they're settled at quarterback. Just talking to Orgeron and Destin, he was more relaxed. Somebody asked him, Ron Higgins from Rivals asked him, did last year kind of turn it around for you? Not really defining what it was, you know, with the fans, with your own credibility. And he said, yeah, I do feel better about myself. Feels better about the program. You could tell he was more relaxed. For all the stories we tell about Ed Orgeron, the minute he became, you know, head coach at LSU, he had changed. He had become more stilted, become more, I guess, dry. And maybe that's something he learned from his previous escapades as an assistant coach and interim coach before. But he's kind of loosened up, and you've seen it in coaches over the years when they get that feeling, like, all right, we got it going, you know, we're a little bit of job security. He got an extension through, I want to say 22, I think, through the 22 season. So that's, you know, that's a good sign. But again, things can turn, you know, in the SEC, things can turn quickly. Auburn, LSU, go down the whole list. You know, you're a 7-5 season away from pressure.
Anecdotally, a real quick question for both y'all. Do you think that football coaches who are capital F football guys mm-hmm. have really bad poker faces when it comes to the state of their program? Like, you can figure out by looking how much they're squirming or how confident they are as to what maybe the really good recruiters have better poker faces. Like maybe James Franklin's not going to let you know if he's really, really worried about his offensive line.
Yeah.
But I feel like Coach O is one of those guys Mac where Brown you can tell.
One, yeah, Mac Brown could be 1-12 and he'd be cheery. But no, you're right. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Barton. Didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, I wanted to ask about the A&M situation too. So Woodward leaves A&M. A&M goes and hires Ross Bjork, the AD from Ole Miss. Dennis, I'm curious your reaction to that hire. What's your big takeaway in terms of significance, impact of A&M, you know, grabbing Ole Miss's guy?
Well, I think it's great for Ross Bjork, and I think it's great for A&M. Ross Bjork was, say what you want about, you know, he was, you know, in charge of a program that suffered institutional control in a 2-year bowl ban. On a personal note, he gets out of that dumpster fire and ends up at A&M, where the resources are doubled than they are at Ole Miss. So great for him. I also think he's a really good athletic director. and he knows how to unite people. So for a guy who, you guys remember that hostage video they made when the sanctions for the investigation came out?
Yeah.
It was Vitter, the president, Hugh Freeze, and Ross Bjork. It looked like they were in North Korea being, you know, told, here, read this or we'll shoot you. You know, he's come a long way, and he is a very good athletic director, got rid of Andy Kennedy for better or worse, got Kermit Davis, who I think was the SEC coach of the year in basketball, and built a brand new basketball arena. And, you know, Ole Miss football is what it is. It hasn't fallen off the end of the earth, and it is in capable hands for now with Matt Luke. It's still very, very young as an AD. I think it's a win-win for both sides.
So one thing that, I mean, this is a very A&M move to me too, because I mean, they're, you know, it's an old money. We're going to go do what we can do to win, because the guy is, I mean, on the surface, he's leaving a program in which the football program is on probation or, you know, dealing with sanctions. And he basically stood behind his head coach throughout those sanctions or throughout that investigation until the, you know, the off the field stuff came up that he couldn't defend. So it's almost like A&M saying, like, look, man, like you got it. You got Ole Miss rolling, and we don't even care what the aftermath was. You got them rolling. We need all our horses we can get to align this thing to get us rolling as well. So here's your money. Come on and let's roll. And,
That's the mentality. A&M is going so hard
right now.
This is if money was coal, the train would be going 500 miles an hour. You know, just throw money at it. This goes back to God. What year did I do that? I did this big piece on the stadium, and then somebody wrote a great headline. It was, you know, Johnny Manziel and Big Oil, because that's how they got the money, the half a billion dollars to renovate Kyle Field. And think about the mentality here. Not only renovated it, but took down the west side of the stadium to the ground and built it up in one offseason, making sure that they had not only more seats than Texas, but had the biggest stadium in the state of Texas, you know, just because they could. And the, John Sharp, he's either the chancellor or president, I can't remember what, widely quoted is saying, when people walk into this stadium, we want them to piss in their pants. I used it in the story. That's the mentality of A&M. And the other side of that is, when I did that story, I walked out of Kevin Sumlin's office, and the last thing he said to me is, now we just have to win. You know, like this ominous, like, you know, if we don't do this, then, you know, everybody's in trouble. Of course, he was in trouble, but no, they're just going to throw money at it until they do it. One national championship, 1939. Last Big 12 championship was in 1998. And they see everyone around them prospering. Now Texas is rising, and that galls them to no end. So this is just part of the mentality. They will keep shoveling coal into the engine till it gets up the mountain. And it'll be interesting to see how that takes shape.
Oh, as an uninvested bystander, I am entertained by it. I am ready to see where this goes as Texas A&M continues to throw money at things. Hey, one of the big topics, at least from the fan perspective, mentioned it briefly earlier, was the SEC lifting a longstanding ban on alcohol. That did it feel as big in Destin, as big of a deal in Destin as it did in terms of the conversation within college football? Because I understand this happens on two reasons. Number one, you're a fan who is going to these games. These are massive stadiums. They have many fans, and they're interested in whether or not they're going to be able to purchase alcohol throughout the stadium, not just in premium seating. But then number two, it was, you know, late May. There was nothing to talk about. College football and tailgating's on people's minds, and the idea of alcohol made it just like a fun talk show conversation throughout the college sports community. What were the main buzz points or the points of tension that you could tell from being there in Destin?
It's a big deal because it's the SEC. Whatever the issue was, the SEC being the last holdout in anything is a story. This just happened to be alcohol. And in the Deep South, in the Bible Belt, with all the moral, religious, and philosophical implications they had to get through to do this, this was big news. You know, what happened was, you know, they just removed the ban that SEC schools couldn't serve alcohol in general public seating. That's been in place since at least 1978. So you can see how big a deal it is. Not all schools will do that. I think Auburn and Alabama have already said, no, we're going to keep things as is. Whereas schools like A&M and LSU are, yeah, let's go, baby. You know, all those seats, all those people, you know, and even an aside here, I hope the earth doesn't become a smoking crater in space after LSU starts serving alcohol in the stands. That's like putting out fire with gasoline, but that's another story for another time. But no, I thought it was a big deal on that level. And then the fact that Greg Sankey, the commissioner, interjected a personal note on his own in explaining this, that I've had family issues basically that would lead me to believe this is not a great decision on a personal note. And we're all looking at each other going, what are you talking about? Well, it was off the record, but he explained some things afterwards regarding family issues. And a lot of people have had this in their life and their families. And I admire him for bringing it up and at least off the record talking about it. So it's not all, you know, ha 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 fun. You know, let's make jokes about sneaking booze into the stadium. There is an alcoholism in America component to this, which should be very sensitive to people. So, no, on a lot of levels, I thought it was big news that it happened in early June, late May, made it perfect to be big news in the off season.
But and I mean, people are sneaking booze in regardless.
Sure.
College students are going to, I mean, I don't know, like NFL games doesn't seem to be a major problem and the college students still have to show their ID. So, while I understand alcohol abuse can be a serious issue at times, like this strikes me as just sort of, it's kind of past due. It's like, Well, it's one of those deals that, like, in 5 years, we'll be talking about this and be like, I can't believe that they didn't sell, you know, beer at stadiums at one point.
It's long been proven, actually, what you just said. In 2011, West Virginia kind of became the first school to change and do it. I think they had served it at Colorado for years. It just wasn't an issue there. But
it's not like West Virginia going full speed in the party.
No, and that's the point. They had a people were, as it was described to me by Oliver Luck, the old AD, now commissioner of the XFL, they would party so much. And it wasn't just beer. It was bourbon. The security people at Milan Puskar Stadium had, when they get on the radios, they go, we have another code V in section 37. What's code V? Code vomit. They'd have to go clean up vomit. So they got, and then they had passouts where Mountaineer fans could go out to their cars at halftime and continue drinking. So they decided, you know, to stop the passouts, to control what you could buy. That's a big thing here. You're only allowed two drinks per visit, got to show your ID. And it worked. Things got better. And obviously there's a revenue component to it as well. You know, you're making money. But again, if I've seen it, you know, they did a pilot program at the College World Series that noted free-for-all, that hedonistic Woodstock of partying at the College World Series, by the way. I don't know why they did it there. And it worked. So, you know, now it just becomes a question of, you know, how you can manage it. And I think it'll be fine in the SEC.
You also got a chance recently, news story up on CBSSports.com, taking a look at Jeff Collins's vision for Georgia Tech. And the... You know, we discussed after his introductory press conference how he certainly was trying to bring some new age vision to what a college football program should be. And when you've been operating under the tenure of Paul Johnson, there's probably some updating when it comes to, you know, the general idea of how you want to promote yourself, how you want to utilize things like brand and marketing, and how you want to present yourself, not just to fans, but also to future recruits. What do you feel like you learned from getting a chance to write that story?
You know, other programs have kind of done this, but maybe not to this extent, where Jeff Collins is very self-aware of himself and that program. You know, Georgia Tech is not a national player. They've kind of spun their wheels. Paul Johnson, you know, great job, overachieved, won an ACC title, won a division there. But he grew up there. He was born there in nearby Conyers, Georgia, and he thinks it can be so much more. He coached under George O'Leary when he was there. He's invested in the community and in the school. And so when he does these kind of funny things like bringing Easter bunnies to a spring scrimmage to hand out candy to the kids, but strategically bringing five Easter bunnies, one for the four national championships Georgia Tech claims and the one they're going to win under Jeff Collins, then that sends a message. He's got an analytics guy who's a 31-year-old former Temple offensive lineman who's been to the Sloan MIT Analytics Conference at MIT to gather information. His old position coach at Fordham, a guy that hired him as a GA, Vince Singalar, is the chief of staff who, it's very obvious, is the gatekeeper. You walk in and you don't get to Jeff Collins unless you pass his office. And, you know, he kind of looked at me when I was there. Who are you? Well, here's who I am. Okay, all right. You know, you can go in. It's just different. He does things a different way. He has coaches during 7-on-7 drills. You know, you don't get anything done defensively in 7-on-7, basically. So he has assistant coaches hold up signs of Star Wars characters or rappers to imitate pass rushers to distract the quarterback a little bit. He's a big Star Wars guy. He's had Young Jeezy jump into the huddle during spring practice. He has a lot of teams have music playing during practice. He hired his own DJ Teflon out of Atlanta to spin disc during the practice. It never lets up. So they play? Yeah, they're probably going to be last in the Coastal this year, but I think they're going to be better. I think it's a good approach.
It's got to be exhausting to be thinking of all those ideas all the time and like trying to incorporate so many different things. I mean, I respect the hell out of it, but how is there enough like space in the brain to like continue to like think of not only bringing Easter bunnies, but bringing five Easter bunnies for that specific reason. And like feeling like you need a DJ at practice, props to him. And I think he's a pretty good football guy too. Like,
I do too.
He's not just a gimmick guy. I think he's actually got some football chops, but it's remarkable that he like has that much, you know, just real estate in his brain to come up with all this stuff.
Yeah, he is. You're right. I was sitting there and he said in his office and he said, what was your number? I said, what are you talking about? My number? I didn't play. And he goes, well, I played hockey. I was number three. So he pulls out this little card in the shape of a Georgia Tech football player and writes three on it. And he goes, I just got these in. These are my new business cards. And on the back of this little character, Georgia Tech player, it's got all his contact information. And he calls that his closer. So when he has kids into his office, he'll say, what's your number? 72. Writes 72 on the front of his business card and says, call me anytime. And that's how they leave the office. It's little things like that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And God knows there's talent there. He made the connection that, well, we're midway between Clemson and Alabama. Maybe we can make enough noise to get some of those players too. That remains to be seen. You can get players at Georgia Tech, just maybe not the ones that Alabama and Clemson are getting. But, you know, Martin, you made a good point. He made his chops at Mississippi State and Florida as a coordinator. I think in 4 of the 6 years he was at those places, his defenses were in the top three in takeaways in the league. And he did a lot of this stuff at Temple, going 15-10 in 2 years, but nobody noticed because it was Temple. So a lot of our people, you know, will notice now, and I think it's fun. I think it's a good way to approach it.
That is Dennis Dodd. You can follow him on Twitter at Dennis Dodd CBS. Dennis, thank you very much.
All right, man. Thanks, guys.